This is a Glass Box Media podcast.
Lauren.
Mike.
So we host a podcast for Wired called Gadget Lab.
We do.
We do.
Yes, that is correct.
Tell the good people some more about it.
Well, I think the good people should definitely tune in every week because they get to hear me roasting you.
Hey, now.
All right. No, really, what Gadget Lab is Mike and I tackling the biggest questions in the world of technology. I like to think of it as the best of Wired's journalism, but in audio form. We cover the big news of the week in techland, but we also offer our expert analyses and opinions on all things consumer tech, whether that's mobile apps, hardware, startups, cryptocurrency. Mike, what's been a recent highlight episode for you?
We did a deep dive on the group behind the massive Okta hack. Mm-hmm. We also had a great conversation about Web3 and the metaverse. What stands out for you?
Never metaverse you didn't like. I really enjoyed our recent podcast about Peloton. And recently, the legendary tech journalist Kara Swisher joined us to talk all about Elon Musk and the future of Twitter. So I guess we should tell people how they can listen to our pod.
We release a new episode of Gadget Lab every week, and you can listen and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you pod.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Around the Coin. I interviewed Sushil Prabhu, the CEO of Drop, today. Drop.cc, spelled DROPP.cc, is the website. Drop is a pay-per-use transaction platform designed to make it easy for consumers to purchase small-value goods and services like micropayments securely without signups. Their first focus is the creator economy. We talked about the evolution of payments from bundled software payments to SaaS subscription payments. We talked about the transition that crypto and decentralized payments will present, the influence that Visa, MasterCard have on the payments industry. Sushil has been in the game a long time. He's been around through the 70s, 80s, the dot-com. He is very seasoned and experienced, and I enjoyed hearing about the trends over time, and observing the patterns and observing the trends help us understand where we are today. Drop is an exciting company, and I learned a lot from Sushil. I hope you do as well. If you do, please subscribe to the podcast and share the podcast with friends. It really does help us grow, and I very much appreciate it. So without further ado, here is Sushil Prabhu. All right, Sushil, I'm excited to be talking with you. You started a company called Drop. You've done many things prior to that. Where were you when the concept for Drop hit you? I mean, what in your life set up starting this company?
Sure. So prior to Drop, we had a company called, and we still have it, called Open Crowd. It's a company that we had started in 2005, focusing on fintech innovation, specifically for mostly for banks and investment banks in Manhattan, in New York City. That's where we started the company. So the concept of Drop actually came out in the tail end in the last couple of years as we were focusing a lot on blockchain technology, distributed ledger technology. And that's when we realized that there was a need for micropayments and the technology was right there. And we saw a lot of different companies tried and then give up. We came up with this concept while we were working with this company called Hedera Hashgraph. It's a distributed ledger company. And we decided to just go with it. Right? And we spun out a new company in 2019, 2020. And it's a brand new company. It's a very exciting space. It's a real need out there. So yeah, that's what we came up with.
Yeah. And how do you articulate the problem that you're solving?
The problem that we're solving is, in the last 20 years, we've all seen that the digital services market has done very well. Everything from video streaming to content creation to now, I think we are about to get into the new world of metaverse. All of that is going on extremely well. But there seems to be only two ways by which you sell products and services. So monetization has only happened either through subscription and or through you offer it free and put ads on it. And both of them are pretty attractive models out there. But I think both these models have reached saturation. You can only subscribe to so many services. And I just don't mean streaming. It, everything that you buy in the market, it could be you renting a scooter in New York City or San Francisco, or having video surveillance in your house, right? Everyone's got a video camera and you pay $5, $10 a month for subscription. Everything is subscription-based. So we've come to a point where, and especially after pandemic, when the digital services have exploded. There are more digital services company now than we have ever had before because we all got used to it. It's not just you and I, but the mass population in the world has got used to digital services. What does that means is every new digital services company that comes out is competing for that same customer population because that's the same population which everyone else is going after. There has to be an alternative method. And basically, consumers need a choice. They need a choice how they buy. I mean, we all are used to buying by usage. You pay your electric bill by usage. I mean, you walk into a convenience store. This is an example I give everyone. You walk into a convenience store, you don't buy a soda by subscription. You buy a can of soda and you walk away. So you have options in the physical world. The digital world, which is so sophisticated, somehow is still based on a flat fee, no option. You got to keep paying every month, whether you use it or not model. So I think it was an interesting model when it came out, subscription model, because only 20 years back, we were buying software on an annual contract. If you remember, you would buy Microsoft Word on an annual contract. And then Salesforce came out with this subscription model and we all jumped into this. I think time has come for us to move a little further and say, let's buy it by usage. I'll only buy by usage. And there's a lot of benefit that will happen. It's not a new concept. It's all we're doing in this drop platform is bringing what we are already used to in the physical world to the digital world. And I think it's going to go to the next world too, which is the metaverse and everything else that comes out of it.
Yeah. I suppose the reason, and tell me if you disagree, that it's not currently structured that way is that there's no cost to provide software, or there's, you know, extremely little, and there's no marginal cost. So, or extremely little. So in the case of electricity, there is a load that the network takes when you turn on your oven, and that has to be, you know, natural gas or coal or nuclear or whatever means of energy production to provide that. Where in the case of software, for me to use, you know, Trello or Evernote or some tool every day, it must cost the company an extra penny, you know, a couple pennies at most. There is currently, right, there is a marginal cost associated with file sharing. I think of like Google and Dropbox as having increased ratcheting tiers for storage. Yeah, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so you're right. The pay-per-use model in the digital world is not going to be identical to the physical world. But let's go back to you buying cloud services, right? Or you buying, let's say, data API if you're a developer. I know how much I'm going to use. I'm going to call this API 100 times. I'm going to call it 1,000 times. And I'll only call it when I'm just going to make this scenario, when there's a peak load, right? I mean, this is what Amazon already does that, right? And so I'm only going to pay for what I use. So you're right, not everywhere, but there's a lot of instances, whether it is for data monetization, API monetization, it could be video streaming. I don't want to pay for a fourth or the fifth service that I just came out and I like the movie on it. You know, or I'll give you a better example. I give the streaming example all the time, but that's been talked about a lot. If I'm a student, okay, and I'm doing some research, not everything is free out there on Google or the internet. There are lots of publications that are very expensive. I would like to buy this one chapter on which I'm writing an article on. I can't do that. I'll have to buy a very expensive publication where I pay $500-$600 a month, right? To do that. So there is a lot of benefit. And you're right, it's not direct, that not everything needs to be unbundled, but there are certain aspects, there are certain products out there, I can very easily see, and I would say there are a lot of that, by the way, not just some of them, which can be very easily unbundled. And both the merchants can make money off it, right? And the consumers now just have more options to buy, right? So it's extremely beneficial. Now, if a product is already offered for $1 a month, I'm with you on that. Like, I won't even bother. Like, I'll give you an example here, right? I use Netflix. I've been a Netflix member since 1999, right? Very early on. I will never not subscribe to it. I will. It's so convenient. I use it every day, right? Now, there are other services, and I don't want to just go after this. I have two or three of them. But at some point, you reach a saturation point. You're saying, I like that movie, but I'm not going to subscribe, and then cancel it. So if you look at all the numbers, and let's just take an example of streaming video. If you look at Netflix, Disney, HBO, many of these services, they've all reached saturation. So there's only so many families in this country who can actually afford the third or the fourth, even the first service on a flat fee. So the market is ready. You asked me a question, why did we think about building this platform? Because I think there is an appetite, there is a need, and there is technology that will make that possible. So that's when we made a decision that let's go ahead and build this platform and out there. And when you look at the crypto world, there's the NFTs, there's all sorts of services that are out there that you might want to buy in a micro level. And then one last thing, which we didn't even talk about, is just look at smart grids, smart cities. Look at IoT devices. The data that two devices, two machines, not sell each other, but send to each other, all of those alerts. An example would be you're driving your electric or your connected car. And at some point, you might be able to sell that data to a smart grid. And I'm not telling you someday, it might even happen this year, where a smart city grid would require your data and would pay you. For privacy, I'm going to ask you, can I take that data because it's going to help me build a better traffic management system? I'll pay you 15 cents for that. There is no micropayment or there's no payment services for device-to-device communication, pay monetization of device-to-device communication. Or if you have a car which is generating electricity and you want to supply it back to the grid, if you make that up, and that's a real case here. I'm not making this up. There's a real case there. There is no payment service which can give you 15, 20 cents for anything under $20. There is no efficient way of monetizing and providing a service to do that. So there's a lot of cases.
Interesting. Yeah. And do you view the problem from a product standpoint as being the transaction costs on credit cards? So the structure of the, like, the 2.5% plus 30 cents just doesn't facilitate very small transactions? Or how do you view the crux in the current system that makes this a problem?
You did hit on a good point. Absolutely, the credit card fees does not. Almost every payment method out there, and there's a lot of innovative. It's a very crowded market. There's a lot of payment platforms out there, and you can start with PayPal, Stripe, Square, and there are hundreds of them. All of them are built on the credit card network, right? And the innovation has happened, but it's been happened for anything above $20. And I just put that number because if you do the math, $20, $10, $5, it's like it becomes very economically unfeasible for a merchant to offer that. So you're right. The credit card payment system does add a wrinkle if you want to offer something for a dollar. If you want to do a micro donation right now, I mean, this is one of the cases we are working on. If you want to do micro royalty, let's say you're a music artist and you have your music in one of the music websites, and every time someone else listens to your music, I would like that credit given to me right away, even if it's 10 cents, because it adds up, right? For music artists, especially artists who are coming up, liquidity or having a cash flow is an issue, right? You can't do that. You can't do that with the credit card payments. I mean, I can't tip you a dollar if I wanted to. If I'm a fan of yours, if I want to tip you, I could tip you, but by the time you get that, it'll be a lot less. So the credit card system that were built, they were really built for larger payments. They were really never meant for this. So it's time for everyone to think about a completely new system where you can make $1 million payments, but also think about the payments that are going to be made in small quantities. So yes, the credit card network does add a wrinkle to this and does make it very difficult.
It seems to me like there's this, hey, you gave the example of Microsoft early on selling bundled software, Salesforce coming around and selling a subscription. Then as I think of it, the space between that is the space where you pay per how much you use, but it's not incremental based on tier plans, because the tier plans has been popular for a long time. It's kind of part of the subscription. You pay for basic or premium or enterprise or whatever the names are, and they ratchet up. You're thinking about people or companies who are allowing their customers to pay based on maybe how many minutes they view Netflix. So if Netflix were to move to this model, instead of paying $8 a month, it'd be like 2 cents a minute or something. So months where I don't watch Netflix, I don't pay anything, and vice versa.
Or Mike, it could be as simple as, I don't want to tell Netflix how to run their business, but I'm flying from Los Angeles to New York. It's a 6-hour flight, and I just want to do a micro subscription for what, 5 hours? And that's a small. Right. So I do say micropayment, but I really like the word small value transactions. Right now, this model really, if you really drill down, this model really, the more I think about it, is for small medium businesses who are struggling to get customers. And here's my theory. If you start any digital service, so let's say you have a podcasting services, you want to offer that as a paid service to your customers, the only way you can do that and build is you need to have awesome content on your website, which you do have, but you need to build momentum. And so it takes you 1, 2, 3 years of offering free services or putting an ad there before you can make money. Now, you can do that if you have a lot of money, if you have a lot of investment in you, or you have to go to a venture company and get yourself $5-7 million so that you can offer these services free, and sometime maybe $50-100 million to offer this free before you can make any money. With pay-per-use, I consider pay-per-use, the best thing in the world is free. Okay, it's the easiest thing to do is, if I offer you free, I'm going to click on it, right? Hey, I'll try it out. I think pay-per-use is the next best thing after free. And then after that is subscription. For subscription, I need to think about it and like, well, I got to pay, you know, once a month. Am I going to use this? And the chances are you saying no to a new service on subscription is very high, right? So we call pay-per-use as a bridge between free, right, and the premium and the subscription service. Right, it really creates that bridge. So it's not like saying no to free or no to subscription. It's like there is no layer in between. Let me try out something for next 6 months, and then I'll go with subscription. You know, that's the whole idea here.
Yeah, it does. It's probably worth calling out the tension between what both parties want, right? Like Netflix, in the case of them, we're representing all SaaS companies. They want you to pay every month. They hope that you use the software and that you get value from it. But ultimately, they're optimizing for the payment. You could see this this exploitive difference most clearly when you sign up for a company. I hesitate to name the name, but I signed up for one recently and I put my credit card in, use it to find a babysitter for my kid. And then to try to unsubscribe, I have to call them. And they're only available like 8 to 5 Eastern time and no holidays. And there's a long wait time. They make it really, really hard to unsubscribe. And then it's like, what are they doing? They're trying to optimize for you paying them regardless of you getting value out of that exchange. And people get upset about that, reasonably so. I can see how a company like Netflix would not want to set an expiration date. So if I sign up for Netflix and I say, hey, I only want to use it for 6 hours. Imagine I sign up today and there's a feature. It's like a drop down. It's like, would you like automatic cancellation of your plan? And I say, yes. And then it says, well, when do you want us to cancel it? And then they can prorate that. Yeah. It seems like they could do that technically, but boy, it seems outside their financial incentive.
Outside this thing. I mean, it's like the gym membership, right? And I wrote an article the other day. Even gyms, you go to a fitness center, it used to be like you could never unsubscribe or you could never kill that membership. They would say, come tomorrow, let me talk to you. When you walk in, they'll say, it'll be difficult. I should actually call and see if I can kill it. And you also are guilty that you don't want to kill that membership because you're going to be unhealthy. So, but even them, if you look at, and it's really important to know that even the physical world where membership was a part of the deal, like that's the only way you could get it, even they have moved to one-day membership, right? There's a lot of gym where you can say, I got a one-day pass, right? Airlines have done that. You just buy the seat and everything else, all the frills you add to it. I'm saying the digital world has to move in that direction. You know, whether it's micropayment or whatever you want to call it, it needs to be unbundle those services so people can pick and choose what they want to buy. And I strongly believe, I keep bringing up Netflix, but really this is not meant for the Netflixes. This is meant for any business which has competition with incumbents. So how do you get there? Well, you get there by let people try their products and services. And as they try and they get comfortable, you can definitely offer them subscription. There is no middle ground is the whole idea. And that's what the unmet need is. Well, you know, if you look at the market, there's not a lot of families. I mean, there's a general population that can affect. And then there's this whole financial inclusion aspect of it where there's a lot of families who really can't afford the subscription, right? And so if you offer them the option to buy as you, what you need, buy by consumption, pay by consumption, right? It would be, you will definitely find 30-40% of the population that can afford it will be able to buy it. You just find a wider customer base when you offer those services. And it doesn't take long. The reason merchants don't do that, it's not economically, it doesn't make sense, right? If I'm selling you something of $5 or even I'm selling for $1, and I have to pay 40 cents or 38 cents to some payment service, then it makes no sense because there's not that much higher of a margin. So by building a system, providing a payment service where you can offer services at a much lower rate, and so the payment service makes revenue, makes money, and then the merchant makes money, I think this is a much better solution. It's a new idea. It's been talked about. It's been talked about forever. Okay, it's a new concept and it's a new category, and people are warming up. I also believe, and we've been talking to a lot of merchants on this, is you can do a lot of innovation when you try to unbundle the services, right?
Yeah, I love that. You know, you're paving out something new. How's it going? Give me, where are you in terms of scope, people working in the project or money raised or revenue, however you measure it?
Sure. So, let me give you a little bit of history so I can take you there.
Sure.
The first thing that we built, which also spurred up why we built Drop, is we built a product called Dragon Glass. Dragon Glass is, think about Dragon Glass as like Etherscan of Ethereum. Dragon Glass is the Etherscan for Hedera Hashgraph, which is a distributed ledger platform. So we launched that in 2019. Lots of users are using it, subscribing to the API. And once that was built, because it gives you instant access to all the ledger information. After that, in 2020, we started building Drop, right? The first year was just constructing, creating a proof of concept, then showing it, then MVP, all of that stuff that you go through. And then we came to a point where we had to make sure that it's compliant because we wanted to. One of the things I didn't mention this to you is we did want to build a micropayment platform, but we also wanted to make sure that it could be utilized by a common person, meaning someone who's not just a crypto expert. One of the things that we've noticed in the market is many of the micro solutions out there expected you to buy and sell crypto or use only crypto. So we built a platform which has two payment rails, and just call it two rails. One is fiat and the other is crypto, right? And it was very important for us because I'm a big crypto person. I mean, we've been in the crypto industry for the last 5 years, so we understand it very well. But it's still not out there for the masses. I mean, you can't expect someone to buy or subscribe to a content with crypto because now you're asking them to buy. So there's a lot of friction there. So we built a platform where you can buy, you can use US dollars in this case, or you can use HBAR, which is the Hedera currency, right? So that was our first proof of concept. And we built it. And then we went through the whole compliance thing, which is to make sure that we could actually offer this without any issue with FinCEN in this country. So we got legal opinions and we had to actually change the platform to make sure that it is. And then after that, we built it on Google, Android, and on iOS. And then in 2021, February is when we realized that now this is it. Now we can start not launching merchants on it, but now people can use it. We could actually build real demos on it. And then at some point in 21, we tried the platform on Dragonglass itself, right? Where you could buy APIs. If you go to dragonglass.me, you can buy APIs like for 49 cents, you can buy 1,000 APIs instead of subscribing. So first thing we wanted to do is use the product that we built and that we're promoting. And then we saw most of the programmers were buying APIs, like 1,000, 10,000 APIs. There's a little scale there. And you can change the scale and it'll tell you how many cents and you just click on it and you can buy it. And then in February of this year, a couple of months back, is the time when we launched it with the creator economy. So we studied the market for a while. We had a lot of email campaigns. And we went after video streaming, micro donations, podcast player. But it resonated extremely well with the creator economy. So in February this year, we launched it with the creator economy. And then in the month of end of this month, which is April, we will be launching it in a large way because we have some promotions that are coming up, and it's going to reach out to about 3,000-4,000 merchants. We also got approved by Shopify, so we will be that's a big thing. So one of the big things that's happening, it's already out. We were going to make a big announcement. The other big thing that we have been working on, and that's why we've been, I wouldn't say we have been quiet. We've been out there, but we haven't announced it. We will be offering USDC. So you can pay in US dollar and you can pay in USDC. So the payment rail is going to have both the stable currency and fiat as a currency. And then we'll also have a WordPress plugin for the creator economy. So all you need to do is download this plugin and you're good to go, right? So that's where we are. I'm very wildly excited about the reception we've received. And I think between the two currency of fiat and the, so again, the theory is that we wanted to build a payment service and a wallet, which is really easy to use. The minute you bring up all the crypto part of it, you start creating friction and then you lose the audience. So we wanted to make it very easy. However, we wanted to use all the cryptography that makes that wallet really, really secure, right? Mm. So I still think it's a challenge, but we're trying to bring all of that together.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the background there. Have you raised money for this? Is this spin out?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Parent company?
Yeah, sorry. Thanks. Yeah. So we put $2.5 million open ground, the parent company from which we spin out. And in April of 2021, we started raising money. We raised about $2 million of angel investment on top of that $2.5 million. And we're going to raise, now we've decided to raise $1.5 million before we get into Series A.
Got it. Awesome. And why did you guys choose to go with Hedera?
So there's a history, both in terms of relationship and technology-wise. So in 2017, in the company OpenCrowd, where we were helping engineer a lot of products, we were working with Hedera Hashgraph. My development team was working with Hedera Hashgraph as an engineering partner. So we were the company that was, they were the engineers, and we, once the product was rolled out in 2019 is when they went live. So we know the product intimately. That's one. The second is the transaction cost is very low. So one of the key reasons behind the technology here is by using a ledger, I'm using the word distributed ledger, not blockchain, because it is it's not a blockchain, Hedera. It's a distributed ledger. Our technology footprint is smaller, right? And the transaction cost is smaller, right? The way we're using the product, and that enables us to reduce the transaction costs. Right now, we charge a merchant 5 cents on a dollar, right? So, and that's 5% on the first dollar. That means even if they charge 10 cents, it'll be 5% of 10 cents, right? And we do that till the fifth dollar. And after that, it is 1% plus 25 cents, right? So at any point, and hoping, and you can go to a fraction of a cent if you want to, but not that there are that many use cases, but we are cheap at any point. And whether it's $1 million or it is 1 cent, right? So we made the transaction cost really low. And the way you can do that, the way we did it, is by using the ledger to do all the ledger accounting calculations. And everything is managed there in the ledger. It's also has become the platform for complete transparency. So you don't have to trust Drop. You can just actually use Dragonglass or any other explorer and access that information. So, the promise of blockchain has always been, or the decentralized, has been transparency, immutable, and the fact that you can do transactions really, really fast in real-time settlement, right? We use all those three properties to create this platform.
Interesting. And yeah, I love it. And with Hedera, what were the leading, certainly given your familiarity with Hedera, there's a bias towards using it, which makes sense, a logical bias. Did you look deeply at other distributed ledgers? Was Ethereum on the table or other Solana?
By the way, we do use Ethereum. I'm sorry, Dragonglass was initially built on Ethereum. It was an explorer for Ethereum. So we are very familiar with Ethereum. The transaction cost, Mike, just makes it not feasible to build a micropayment platform. And that time, and the transaction speed, another, so it's a transaction cost and the speed. I mean, that's the most common thing we talk about in the blockchain industry. This is 2019-20, where the transaction cost was really high on Ethereum to do a micropayment. So you'll be spending more cents, more dollars on sending 10 cents than making any money on it. In fact, I think it would have been more expensive than a credit card. But also the transaction speed. So one thing we didn't talk about is when we talk about the building a payment infrastructure for the digital economy, you're also talking about, let's say there's an IoT transaction. There is a transaction between a connected car and a smart grid or two devices. Those transactions happen in split seconds. So, and a lot of them happen in a minute. So you need a throughput. And it's very important. And that's going to be the future. And you will see that, although this is more of conceptual, you will see the same thing in the metaverse. It's not going to be the credit card payments. It probably is going to be crypto or some sort of a digital payment system like Drop. It has to be, because the speed, the number of transactions you're going to do, small transactions in a minute, is going to be a lot more than what what goes on the credit card network. The throughput of Hedera Hashgraph is very large. It's right now, even in this phase, it is 10,000 a second. There are now other blockchains technologies like Solana, and many of them offer it. But I'm talking about, this is 2019, 2020. There were none. There were absolutely none there. So yeah. And now we use the token system, and it's still very, and it's a fixed price. Oh, one more thing. It's a fixed price. So it's not like the gas, it goes up and down, it's fixed. So it's perfect. I mean, it's 100% perfect for what we wanted to do.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, I dig it. I'm actually not that familiar with it. So it's fun to hear your description and critique of the distributed ledger, the protocol at Hedera. Yeah, interesting. So how do you sort of see the do you agree with the idea that transaction costs for payments are going to decrease across the spectrum of transacting for a penny all the way up to $1 million, and that there's an incredible amount of pressure from on Visa, MasterCard, the credit card networks, and that they're looking at this situation and saying, we know that our margins are going to get pinched by the innovation on blockchain, and then it's just a matter of integrating the, if you think of the what we're doing as a society or a civilization, we're taking this distributed ledger system, this blockchain, and we're figuring out what the best methods for payment transactions are in different applications of what people are buying. But at the end of the day, the credit cards are the ones that are going to be leapfrogged. They're going to be surpassed.
They're going to be surpassed. Okay. All right. So a couple of points there, right? And I'll sort of express my point of view a little later, but let me first answer your question. I'm very sure that the credit card networks are looking into revamping their infrastructure. And I said revamping is rebuilding on a completely different platform. I don't have any insight, but if I was them, I would. I mean, this infrastructure that I've done very well in the last 50 years, it was built 30, 40 years back and it was upgraded, but really, when you build system, the kind of the payment system I'm talking about, like even Drop, which is not big like Visa or any of the big credit card companies, it is just far more efficient, right? Even the little token systems, like the fact that you have $5 and you paid merchant $100, and when you pay that 5 tokens to the merchant, that whole management, which we take it for granted in the distributed ledger, you got to write thousands of lines of code. Mm. Right? When you're not using a distributed ledger, okay, or blockchain technology. So for them, they have to be looking into this technology. Or else, just like if you miss the boat on open source or if you miss the boat on internet, you'll miss the boat on this. So would they have to? They will have to. I'm just hoping that when they revamp and when they build it on a new infrastructure, they build it on a public distributed ledger, on a public blockchain technology. I hope they do that. I think if you remember in 97, 98, that was a time I was a CTO of a company called Sign, which was in e-business. We were building internet technologies. Lots of banks we were talking to, they were mostly interested in talking to us, but they were also wanting to build it on something called an extranet, right? Which defeats the purpose. It really does. It just gives you a faster connection between two people. What internet did, what open source is, it really got everyone involved, you know? And this is what the creator economy is about. And open source was like the early version of creator economy. You get more people involved in helping you build an infrastructure, right? So I think they will, and if they don't, all of these other technologies would leapfrog them. But I think I don't have an insight in this, but I'm 100% sure without insight that they are all looking into some sort of faster technology, hopefully open, an open ledger or an open blockchain technology, hopefully. Because anything else would be meaningless. And I've seen it come out and I've seen I don't want to give an example because I'll be putting down a company, but I've seen large financial institutions come out and say, hey, we just did this on a ledger. And then when you look at it, it's a permission ledger between them and the merchant. Right. I always go back to 98, 97 when, yeah, I've heard this. I've seen this movie before. And it's not going to be successful. You need to have, you need to engage people in it. So, anyway, that's my thing. Now, I want to just tell you one thing. You had asked me a question. I have a belief, and we all in Drop have a belief, that the cost of a transaction is going to continue going lower, right? This is a belief I have, and not everyone agrees with me. And I think some of the people who are big fans of us because they think we're going to do extremely well, they might not like this point of view either. But I really believe that the cost of transaction is going to keep going lower. The way payment systems, payment services like Drop and all of us will continue to make revenue and money is we will have to offer services that helps merchant build their businesses. So what does that mean? If the transaction, well, we offer micro subscriptions. We do. We're going to charge for that. We have loyalty points. We have something called offers. There's a lots of services that a payment service can provide because we know the transaction and we can offer that to the merchant. And that's where all these value-added services is going to be the real value which a payment service is going to provide. That's my belief. And if it won't happen right away, it'll happen in 5 years from now. Just like the trading world, right? Right now, you can trade right now on E-Trade and many of the other companies for free, right? Mm-hmm. But in the early 90s, I used to pay $40 for a transaction. And now I'm paying nothing. So I think it's the same thing that's going to happen.
Yeah, I almost find it hard to disagree with that because, I mean, I'd be curious what the contrarian viewpoint is on that, because it seems like just like technology becoming cheaper over time, software becoming cheaper over time, things move in a positive direction when people work on them. And positive here for the consumer would mean a decrease in the transaction costs of money. Similar to, you know, your example on the trading of a stock, when that goes to zero, when somebody does that, they have to subsidize their income as a company from something else. And so, it naturally makes sense that if you give away a product as a loss leader, you make it up on the backside by adding more value, and you're bundling in what a company would be looking for. So, in the case of say Shopify, let's make transaction costs zero. Why not? It's only 1%. It's 25 cents per transaction. Going that way, anyways. The reason why someone would use it, given there's 10 different free transaction services out there, would be more than that. It would be, hey, they allow us to do email sending or analytics or blah, blah, blah. And then you're paying on top of it for that. Whereas the transaction, instead of that becoming the moneymaker, that's just like a side note. It's like, oh, they have free transaction costs. Of course, so does everyone else.
Absolutely. No, I'm with you, Mike. And that's my thing. Like in Drop, what we've done is, What's the first thing that you do when you like an article? Well, you share it with your friends. You say, hey, did you read this article? What we have done in our service is when you refer someone, right, the merchant now, it's all built into the API. It's all API-based, the whole system. So you can embed it anywhere. But when your friend or anyone in your family, when they buy that content, the merchant has the ability to give you a referral fee automatically, right? So you basically giving the merchant the ability or all the capabilities to make that content go viral. They can monetize it. So you might have bought an article for 50 cents and probably end up making $10 because you shared it in a community and all of them bought it, and the merchant. And the way we build the API, it's all embedded in it, not your name, a hash ID of yours. And then you get in your wallet, when you look at it, you'll start seeing credits. This is exactly how we... So these are all services. Like we also have another one called offers, which is very simple in thinking is if, just one more thing, by the way, in before I get into offers, privacy is another very important thing in digital transactions. Privacy has become more and more important now, right? And especially in micro transactions, when you do 10 transactions and you might have just spent only $5 all day, you're in different merchant sites. Privacy is going to be very important. So one of the things that we do, and I completely forgot to mention this, is we do not share your identity with the merchant. It's very important. We don't share that. We know who it is. It's not anonymous. It's just private, right? So now the merchant has an issue. Like, how do I reach out to this customer, right? Well, we let them do that. We let them make you an offer or send you a coupon or something, but they don't know it's you. All they know is you did buy that article. So it's possible that he might like the next article. So we've left a sort of the gate open without sharing the identity, right? So all of these services, my point was all of these services, the merchant will be more than happy to pay you because now he's got you engaged right on your mobile. Right? It's like an ad that you put in, but it's not like a shotgun approach. We know exactly here. He did read my ear, not my email, watch my movie. I'm going to send him 25% discount for the next movie, and I've got it, right? So these are all the services where payment gateways or payment services would end up making money, which is the value-added services. And that's my belief. It won't happen right away, but in the next 5 years, I think we'll see more and more of that.
Where do you feel like the first early adopting segments of the market are? Do you feel like it's offline or online or some other split of the market between industry?
Good point. So right now, our focus is a creator economy. There's 50 million, and that's the number I've seen in the market. There's about 50 million creators in the world. And many of them, do not have ways to easily monetize their content. I mean, they either have to host it on someone else's website, or they get a marginal value out of hosting on someone's website. But there is no easy way. The only way is using a credit card. So we are actually, that is the need in that economy or in that community is the most. So we are actually definitely going after the digital market. But if you look at small payments is not always digital. You pay for your parking. You pay for, if you have one of the EV cars, you pay for charging. So it's also digital cash, right? Any payment that you make under $10 is digital cash. And less people are carrying cash. So our second sector that we're going to go after is EV infrastructure, which is becoming bigger and bigger in this country. Parking meters, all of them. And if you look at many of the parking wallets, they all use a credit card. That means anytime you pay $2 or $3, someone is not making money. I can guarantee you that. But they're letting you do that because they're hoping you'll use it for larger purchases. Mm. The way we build the system, you don't have to make a large purchase. You make money in every transaction. And that's how we build the system. So, yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. I'm curious to ask you about OpenCrowd. You're the current chairman of OpenCrowd. I'm curious to hear what it is that they do and what drew your attention to them.
Yeah, no, it's been I've been a CEO founder of OpenCrowd for like 17 years. We built the company in 2005. We started the company in 2005 in New York, and the focus then, in a way even now, was helping the financial sector innovate using open source technologies. In 2005, open source is everything right now, but it wasn't. The most common open source that was used was Linux operating system and maybe MySQL database, right? And that's 2005 is the time when LAMP came in, Python started becoming mainstream, but only in Silicon Valley, not in the financial institution. So we helped many of these financial institutions use open source technologies. So we would actually go in there and build the entire infrastructure technology platforms. But the other thing that we were also got involved is helping startups build products, right? So many of the startups would get Series A investment, like under $5 million or sometimes Series A. And then we would become their product company. We would help them build it for like 12 months. And once they launch it, then they would hire their own team and they would kind of fade away. And we in every couple of years, we got into new technologies. It was open source in 2005. 2007, we got into social networking. Facebook had just come out, and using the principles of social networking, we were able to help a lot of businesses for business collaboration. We helped IBM. IBM was a big client then. In 2005, it was Morgan Stanley. And then in 2008 and 9, we got into AWS, Amazon. Very early on, unfortunately, most of the banks were not interested in talking to us just because they felt that it was not something they would ever use, which is not the case right now, by the way. In fact, we were asked to take open source and cloud out of our presentation because they said that's a bad word in the bank. Well, now they all use it.
Yeah. What do you think is going on there? So in the beginning, early days, people are building software. It makes sense to keep it proprietary. They want to maintain total ownership. They view it as their unique intellectual IP, and they don't want people stealing it. I presume fear is the dominant emotion that was early on, just like hardware technology or something else. You wouldn't just publish your, you know, your CAD models or your all your everything publicly. You take the same approach to software. Then the game flips, like you said, with open source and MySQL and Linux and Python, everything else becoming open source. The beauty in open source, the driving factor being that everyone can add to it. When bugs naturally arise, you're going to find out faster. Yeah, somebody might take advantage of that, but the patch will happen quicker, and you're using the intelligence of the masses. And that now is what that was resisted by the banks, because they felt scared, probably, that, hey, if we use software that's being developed publicly, then we would get hacked. This would walk me through what you think the psychological evolution was.
Yeah. No, good question, actually. It does bring me back in the last decade. So I think they like the fact that it's free and all, but there are two things they did not like about open source. And it was a struggle initially. We did not do well for the first year, and after that, we did very, very well. There's no support structure in open source. And most financial institutions, and I can see that, is like, I can't call anyone. So then there were like these open source solution companies or services, support companies that kicked in. And the second is, you're liable. If you get sued, if that piece of code in that open source was stolen from somewhere else, there were major lawsuits with Linux operating system and many of them, and they didn't want that. So actually, we would use software in 2006 and 2007. Like if we recommend a stack, we had to give them all the libraries, and they would use a software from a different company. I'm trying to remember that. And they would scan it and see if there was anything in that software that would infringe on someone's rights. So GPL, we were very averse with all the licensing scheme and all of them. So it was a lot of friction then with open source. So most of the startups saw the value. I mean, that's how Amazon got built. I mean, mm-hmm. You wouldn't have AWS without open source. So it was more about fear, which was put in by some large organizations which were not open source friendly, that, hey, if you use that software, you could get sued for billions of dollars. Okay, so that stopped it, and you have no support. Now, the second thing with cloud, it was all about control, because they had already spent so much money on a data infrastructure. They just couldn't see it. And these are the same banks in 2014 said, do you know anyone who knows S3 or any of the Elastic services from AWS? And we said, you know, we've been doing this for the last 10 years. So it's all about control and fear. You're right about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And they could, so the banks using their own proprietary software systems couldn't see that if a open source, say data storage service is available, they couldn't see using it, because the idea that, hey, all these lines of code are going to be available on the internet for free, available to anyone and worked on by everyone, that concept, what were they fearing? Were they fearing that because it was...
In the cloud, the fear was sort of real. If you look at it, if you're a bank and is they've spent money and all sorts of security system to make sure that the data is right there in front of them in the data center. Mm. Although that was not completely true, because the data centers, you can break into that too. So they just couldn't see taking that customer data and putting it out there in the cloud. There was just a mental shift, right? Unless you give me that security. Also took AWS, and I'm not any cloud, not, it doesn't have to be AWS. All of these cloud companies, it took them about 7-8 years to sort of ensure that security, that we are as safe as your data center, right?
Right.
So right. There were some valid reasons, but there was so much, the fear was so much that when we used to present solution, they would ask us directly, was this built on AWS? Was this built on a cloud? If it was, then we're not a cloud-friendly company. This is 2009-10.
Yeah.
But the startups were, it was perfect. I mean, they didn't have to buy a single hardware, and we would be live in 90 days. Our proposition in the market used to be Once we finish the design, we'll take you live in 90 days.
It makes sense. You know, if you think of a bank, the bank traditionally had giant, I mean, look at like an iconic bank. It's in the middle of the town center. It's got giant columns, which are representing proverbial vaults and safety. Like, we've got armed guards outside, and deep inside is where we keep the gold. And our job is to protect it, like safety of the gold. And so, you know, things change slowly in industries that need to change slowly, like banks, because that's where we place an incredible amount of our stored energy as a society, and accounting, which is critical to the stability of civilization. And so I think of the slow roll of banks forward is, hey, if we have servers, that is the bank. The server is the bank. And so if we're going to give over the trust that we sell to our customers, instead of armed guards, it's security around the data centers. And we're just going to give that to Amazon. It's like, it's a big deal. I mean, it's like, now we think of what is a bank, right? Now you see all these, you know, new web-based banks pop up that have no presence. And it's like, yeah. Yeah. And so it's trust in the open source.
Yeah. But Mike, things have changed. I mean, we've been talking to a lot of banks because of Drop. And I saw the change in 98 when the internet came in. They all started looking at it and they started calling us and we were having deep conversations. They're happening again because they realize that there is a change happening. You know, the customers who are coming to them are different. The way they transact with the bank is different. There is technology out there and they need to use it. So banks are going to move. I would say in the next 5 years, they'll definitely be moving in the ledger technology and all of that. I saw a lot of resistance being open source. I saw it took a decade before they started using some parts of the cloud. They don't use for everything even now. The ledger still remains in the bank. It doesn't go to the cloud. They're only using the cloud for secondary reporting and all those facilities. The real crux, your KIF, which is a customer information file, is still in a physical data center. But now I've seen they are absolutely looking at digital currencies and ways, because their customer base is asking them, what about crypto? So there is a demand. They definitely see the technology. There is still a lot of risk there. And unfortunately, many of the banks have to comply with everything out there. So it's not easy. But they are. You will see a transformation. And also, that's required, because once they start moving in that direction, we will see the DeFi world become larger and larger. And there'll be a lot more adoption of this technology, because you need everyone to come together for something to go up. So
yeah,
I think you will see that very soon. Yeah.
Yeah. I find it kind of interesting, this sort of centralization versus flattening out. And it almost seems like I'm curious to hear your reactions to this. If whether or not it's a linear step forward, like we had consolidation of data and knowledge basically, and then it got flattened out through open source. And the same thing is happening in crypto, where it's a flattening out. It's, hey, let me publish what I have in my wallet to everybody. Therefore, the trust that is correct is as high as it can possibly be. Instead of putting all my trust in one institution to keep track of that, I'm going to show everybody, we can all see it, we all agree on it, and there's consensus in the blockchain. And I wonder if that then gets consolidated again, that that is sort of like an oscillating flow of power and control, that in a way, like, I don't know how this relates, but it also feels the same in the political sphere, where there's the complete, like, pure capitalism and then pure centralization of power. It's there. The answer seems to be somewhere between those. Like, neither one can really work.
You just made me think about this, the oscillation. I think that's a good term, because in the early 90s, we were just before the early 90s, it was all mainframe. Okay. Everything was single. And then we went into this technology called client server, and many of the firms, enterprises got into client server, where there is a Visual Basic front end and a database, Oracle, Sybase, and Ingress in the back end. And then in the mid-90s, we got into the distributed technology, and there was a technology called Corva, which we used to use, which was distributed. And then came the internet, right, which took it to the next level where, in a way, we became centralized because you still have the browser. You have the browser, and then you have something in the back end, right? With the cloud, I feel that we oscillated back because now you have this giant machine, four or five of them all over the world, which, I mean, think about them as a mainframe. They're like super duper computers, and all of us are like little nodes. So we're back to what was there in the 80s, right? So yeah, it keeps oscillating, and you never know with edge computing, things might.
Yeah, edge computing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. But your question about, or your comment on DeFi and CeFi, it's not this or the other. I really believe in, and some of those ideas are also in our drop. I really wanted to make sure that we build drop using the efficiency of the DeFi world, distributed technology. But I also wanted to use the regulated technologies, like we use Plaid, and we use all of that when you fund the account. Because it's not this or the other. You have to pick the best of both. Okay. One of the best things that the DeFi world offers is you can do peer-to-peer transfers of value very efficiently. There is no other technology in the world. No wire transfer, no ACH, no credit card. Blockchain technology has done it better than any other technology. The second is there's no intermediaries. And the third thing, which I really like, is the, you know, when you use smart contracts, the fact that you can escrow something, you can keep it as a custody and release it with some rules. Now, those are very simple things. I mean, anyone who knows blockchain does that. But those three things have been utilized, and so many business models can be built with that. Just as an example, in 2012, in OpenCrowd, we helped a very large investment bank build a collateral management system. Basically the same thing. I've taken your collateral and I'm going to return you when you pay my money back, right? That entire system, it took us a couple of years and millions of dollars. That entire system right now could be built on the DeFi world, I would say within 6 months, and it would be extremely efficient in CPU, in resources, all of that, right? So I'm a very optimistic person. I think that the banks are going to look at that and realize, wow, I don't have to do all this coding. I could just use that. So I'm hoping, and I'm not just hoping, I think it's going to be a hybrid world as we go further. You will still have bank accounts, but you will, for certain things, you will just rely on the technology. And it will be all transparent. I mean, it will not be transparent. Sorry, it will be completely a black box to you, because it's going to be either this or that. You won't even realize.
Yeah.
And that's the world we're going to, it's a CeFi. People saying there are two divisions. There's going to be a bridge. And that's when there'll be mass adoption of blockchain technologies.
Bam.
Yeah. And right now that's the issue. If you look at DeFi world, it hasn't met the physical world yet. It's just virtual out there. You have to connect that NFT world to the physical world. And that's when the common person will start using it. If I can take my tractor, and if I can take it to a pawn shop and create an NFT, and all of you guys can give me a loan on it, then that's the usefulness. It's not that I create an emoji and everyone bought it. Now, how many people create an emoji? If I'm a farmer, or if I'm somebody who's having a tough time running my life, you know, making enough money, and I want to pawn something, and this is just an example I'm throwing at you, I should be able to walk in there to some service, which they scan it, they create a token of it instantly, and 100 people give me a loan, far efficient, far better loan than I would have got from a regular pawn shop.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are 100 people, and they're ready to, and that pawn, that machine is physically stored in it, right?
Yeah. When
those kind of use cases become big, I think that's when the DeFi world is going to become bigger. So I think it's going to be a merging of CeFi and DeFi. I really think it is.
Totally. And I think that the oscillation will be, there'll be a massive spreading out or decentralization of the ability to give and receive loans through NFTs and on-chain lending. And then there'll be consolidation again when people specialize in specific loan areas. So I'm specializing in agricultural tools as a lender on chain. So it's not just anybody who's going to go, like, we're still evaluating this tractor in your case, you know, so knowledge of farming and tractors, all that stuff is still valuable, but now it's open to everyone. So there'll be, I think, a whole new explosion of people realizing this and then saying, hey, I'm a farmer. I'm not making money farming anymore. And maybe let me just become a lender and invest money into on-chain, blockchain, these kind of deals that come up. And I think that's exciting.
That's exciting. Yeah. And I might, the thing is, I'm sure you've been to a lot of conventions any meeting that takes place on the DeFi world. And people talk about financial inclusion and all of this stuff. But really, there's not much financial inclusion happening. The people who are into the crypto are just trading, mm-hmm. right? And that is because most of the, if you're a farmer sitting in a remote part of the world, even in this country, crypto is not what you're doing, right? So I think the promise of DeFi and financial inclusion and all of that that people talk about, it will only happen if you bring that world and connect this to the physical world. So this tractor example is actually a good example in a way, is when you start doing that, I think the efficiency of the DeFi could be utilized by a common person.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where the rubber meets the road. Sushil, it's so fun to get to meet you. I love what you're working on. I love the background. And I love the amount of time that you spent in this industry to see the trends over long periods of time. It's really unique and I appreciate it. Are you writing or tweeting or anywhere you're publicly available?
I write a lot of articles every couple of weeks. I think Payment Journal is about to publish one. Isabella, I can tell you more about it. But yes, I constantly write articles on not just on micropayments, but just the payments and the DeFi world. I don't write a lot on cryptocurrency. I'm not an expert in that. But I definitely do, you know, and I'm definitely on Twitter. So yeah.
And what do you recall your Twitter username? Nice. And I'm sure people can find your articles just from typing in Sushil Prabhu, your name. And are there any particular people or books or anything that you wanted to give a shout out to that you've learned from over the years?
You know, I read a lot when it comes to like the just computer related stuff. But one of the, because I have an engineering background, I look for something beyond engineering. And when it comes to marketing, we had someone who was ahead of our marketing in Signed, a company I worked at in 1998. And his name is Chris Lockhead. And he is something whom I do follow. And it's called the, he has this whole thing about creating a new category. And he has this blog called the Category Pirates. Mm. I follow that all the time. Great ideas on marketing and very revolutionary, very different thinking. And I love reading it. It comes out, I think, every month.
I love it.
His articles. So I subscribe to that.
I love it. Sushil, thanks again and congrats. And I hope you guys keep crushing.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thanks for taking the time.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Around the Coin. If you enjoyed the show today, consider giving us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts, tweet about it, or text it to a friend. We really appreciate all the support and growing that we can. If you have any guests you'd like us to bring on or feedback for us, don't hesitate to reach out. We would love to hear from you.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.